Hi, welcome. My name is Carolyn McGifford. I'm a senior fellow at CSIS and the director of our Smart Power Initiative, which is co-hosting this event with the Freeman Chair in China Studies. The Smart Power, let me give you a little background on the initiative and what we're doing here today and the outgrowth of this report. The Smart Power Initiative grew out of the Smart Power Commission, which was chaired by Joe Nye and Rich Armitage. They were concerned with the declining image and influence of the United States around the world, and in 2007 issued a report with some recommendations on how they thought that the United States could not only regain its inspirational leadership, but also promote the global good. Smart power has become a buzzword since then, and I'm sure you all know that Secretary Clinton has adopted it, used it to describe the Obama administration's foreign policy approach. It is, generally speaking, a look at how to rebalance our hard and soft power tools, how to integrate them, how to use all the tools in our toolbox, how to be principled and pragmatic at the same time, and how to focus on constructive engagement around the world. To follow up on the work of that commission, CSIS convened another commission, chaired by Hank Greenberg and Bill Cohen, looking at U.S.-China relations and how these two major powers could bring their respective soft powers to bear to promote the global good. And they issued their report last week. The executive summary is outside, and you can find the full report online. That commission was trying to step away from the typical debate of pro-China and anti-China, and while it did not ignore the challenges that are in the relationship, it focused on how to not allow those challenges to impede progress in other key areas, and how really the world has changed in such a way that there are a number of key challenges, global challenges, that will require both U.S. and Chinese leadership to have real impact. This commission's deliberations were underpinned by the research and the analysis of the scholars that you'll hear from today. They were charged with testing the assumption that you hear a lot in Washington that the Chinese are eating our lunch around the world, and to defining a baseline of what China is actually doing in developing regions around the world and what does it mean for the United States. We also asked Melissa Murphy and Bonnie Glazer, the Freeman Chair here, to look into how does China see its own soft power strategy? Does it have one? What is the debate going on in China over how it uses soft power and what its objectives are in doing so? And so we're going to start today with that discussion, and then we'll move on to regional perspectives as well. So thank you, Bonnie and Melissa.
Thank you, Carola, and good morning, everyone. This is has been a very interesting project. Melissa and I were in China last fall doing interviews with Chinese experts and officials about Chinese soft power as a part of this project. And we came to the idea of examining China's own perspectives on its soft power because in recent years there's been a spate of publications, books, reports about how China is using its soft power around the world. But there hasn't been, I think, enough that has really examined the internal discourse on Chinese soft power. So these reports that have been released in recent years, many of them in examining how China is using its soft power around the world suggest that Beijing has a coherent and well-coordinated strategy to develop soft power tools and to use them around the world to enhance Chinese influence. Now, some authors have contended that China is seeking to position itself as a model of social and economic success and to develop stronger relationships internationally, even possibly alliances, to counterbalance and to compete with the United States. Joseph Nye, of course, coined the term soft power, and his definition was rather narrow, essentially defining soft power as the passive attraction force of a nation's culture, values, and norms. But some of these publications have suggested that China looks at soft power much more broadly. And I would cite, for example, a book by Joshua Kurlansky, published several years ago, that claim that Beijing has expanded the concept of soft power to include almost any non-military effort at amassing its power. His book, which was entitled Charm Offensive, purported to examine soft power through this alleged expanded Chinese definition or understanding of the phrase soft power. And he concluded that China is using soft power as part of a grand strategy that is aimed at challenging and even supplanting the U.S. role as a as the sole superpower. So we ask ourselves in embarking on this project, is this a correct understanding of China's concept of soft power and the goals that Beijing seeks to attain through applying its soft power throughout the world? And in addition to the interviews that we conducted in China, Melissa and I did a survey of Chinese writings on soft power. We found there's an enormous amount of literature. This is one of the hottest topics in China, and it's not only a recent topic, but actually began to be discussed many years ago when Zhou and I first coined the phrase. It really attracted a lot of attention then. Now, the mainstream view in China is that culture is the core component of soft power. Now, there is a minority view that proposes placing greater emphasis on foreign policy and on political institutions, another soft power means. And Melissa will go into greater detail on this debate and talk a bit about the different points of view among Chinese experts on soft power. Here, I will focus on China's policy and the leadership views about soft power. The leadership in China has embraced the concept of cultural soft power. China's traditional culture, which after years of denigration is now being restored and revived, Confucianism, even Buddhism, there's a lot of attention being paid in China to reviving its past culture. Culture is viewed as a sound and a safe basis on which to build Chinese soft power. Now, values are considered an important part of soft power by the Chinese. The concept of harmony is, of course, an important part of this value set. And we all saw at the Olympics and the opening ceremonies the Chinese character, he, for harmony, that was highlighted. A search is underway in China for a new unifying ideology. It's referred to as a socialist core value system that would replace the now defunct Maoism and Marxism, offering an alternative to Western values. But so far, no consensus has been reached on this new set of values. It is very much still a work in process. There are some seats in the front. Feel free to come on up and sit down. Chinese leaders have recognized that in addition to building China's economic or material civilization, that the nation needs to build what they call spiritual civilization. And indeed, in 1998, when Jiang Zemin was still head of the party and president of China, he announced the decision to build a socialist spiritual civilization, and this was at the 15th Party Congress. So this harks back now many years. But the term soft power has really only been used by Chinese leaders recently. And the first site that we were able to find of Hu Jintao using the term soft power was in an internal speech that he gave to the Foreign Affairs leading small group in January 2006. And President Hu Jintao said in that speech, "The enhancement of China's international status and international influence must be reflected both in hard power, including the economy, science, and technology, and national defense power, and in soft power such as culture." The leadership's official sanction of soft power and this core role of culture was really sealed at the 17th Party Congress, which was in October of 2007. And as you all know, work reports that are delivered at party congresses are extremely important. So if a new term is used, it's considered to set a it essentially sends a signal to everybody that this is an important term for the party, new research should be done on it. This particular term that was used by Hu Jintao was cultural soft power, wen hua ren shi li. And what he said in that report is culture has increasingly become an important source of national cohesion and creativity and an important factor in the competition of overall national strength. And he called for China to enhance the country's cultural soft power. Now, interestingly, in writing the 17th Party Congress report, the ideas, proposals are really collected from various parts of the party and the government. This particular suggestion, we learned, actually came from the Ministry of Culture, not from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And it was suggested to us that the Ministry of Foreign Affairs wasn't particularly happy that it wasn't their idea to apply this to foreign policy. But it shows that there really is an emphasis here on culture. So development of the country's cultural soft power as an important part of its comprehensive national power has indeed become a very important task, along with efforts to employ cultural soft power abroad in Chinese foreign policy. And I now want to turn to a brief discussion of how I think that the Chinese are using soft power in their foreign policy. And the next panel will go into greater detail as to how China is using soft power in particular regions. So what are the primary goals of China's soft power? I would posit that there are essentially three interrelated goals. One is to counter what the Chinese call the China threat theory. There is a great deal of concern in China that there is a widespread perception around the world that China is posing a threat to various countries' interests. And China has put a lot of effort and a lot of money and resources into trying to counter this threat around the world. A related goal is to improve China's image abroad. China wants to be seen as a benign and also constructive power. It does not want to be seen as irresponsible. China does not necessarily share the U.S. or other countries' definition of what a responsible stakeholder is, but they know that they don't want to be seen as irresponsible. And I think, thirdly, the Chinese want to maintain and promote relationships with countries around the world. They want to essentially preserve and strengthen the favorable international environment that they have today to continue their buildup of comprehensive national power. So I would posit that those who have suggested that China's goals are to compete with the United States, to establish an anti-American coalition or even alliances, or export a China development model to compete with the Western development model, these are really not China's immediate goals in seeking to use its soft power around the world. On the issue particularly of the China development model, we certainly have found that discussion of the Beijing consensus, although quite popular among Chinese scholars, is prescribed in official documents. Now, China has yet to develop a comprehensive and coherent national soft power strategies, although it is clear that there are disparate policies toward this end. There's no central leading group in China that has been organized to promote China's soft power or apply it in foreign policy. There's no leader that's been assigned to oversee this particular task. But there are some individual policies that, and I will note a few of them, that China is doing to promote its soft power abroad. One example I think many of you know about is the establishment of Confucian institutes around the world. And these are tasked with disseminating China's culture and particularly language to the world. As of November 2008, there were 307 Confucian institutes in 78 countries worldwide. And the target that China has set is to have 500 Confucian institutes by the year 2010. It is the education ministry in China that is in charge of the establishment and the running and the funding of these Confucian institutes. Now, separately, the Ministry of Culture has received funds to promote cultural events and exchanges around the world. So, for example, 2003 was the year of China in France, 2007 was the year of China in Russia, and we have really seen, I think, an increase in cultural activities and events and exchanges here in the United States and other countries. The central budget for cultural undertakings, we weren't able to find a recent figure for this, but between 2005 and 2006, that budget rose 24%. Diplomatic spending on soft power rose 37% in 2007. That just gives you an idea of at least the increase in resources that's being applied to the development and application of soft power. You may have also read about a new effort underway by China's propaganda department, and they've undertaken a 45 billion yuan project to expand China's media. This is sort of being portrayed as China's effort to build a CNN. And in essence, I think that is what they're trying to do. Xinhua's opening more bureaus overseas. CCTV9 is now establishing new services, not just in Spanish and French, but also Russian and Arabic. Xinhua is also establishing a TV portion. They've so far only been print media. And finally, of course, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs is promoting the concept of harmonious world, and I think Melissa may also talk a little bit more about that. My point here is that there's no apparent coordination among these ministries to promote a broader agenda. And indeed, there's considerable criticism among some scholars in China that not enough is being done to forge a coherent and coordinated strategy. And to date, there really has not been an effort to establish benchmarks for assessing progress in promoting culture as the core of soft power. Now, Chinese scholars disagree about how to measure soft power, and I think we have some of those disagreements ourselves here in the United States among those who've studied soft power. But for those who use indicators such as the number of foreign leaders visiting Beijing annually or the number of Confucian institutes that have been established, or, for example, China's participation in UN peacekeeping operations. For these scholars, China's soft power is seen as rising very rapidly. But for other scholars who use different indicators to measure China's soft power, for example, China's ability to mobilize international support for a position that China takes on an issue. For those kinds of scholars, China's soft power remains quite weak and lags significantly behind the United States. And in that latter group, I would cite, for example, a Tsinghua University professor, Yan Shui-tong, who is one of the few Chinese scholars who has tried to quantify China's soft power. And he developed some indicators, and one of them was China's international mobilization capability, where he essentially said the U.S. has more than 30 allies, China has strategic partnerships, but, you know, when push comes to shove, strategic partnerships don't mean very much. Countries will stand with the United States. They will not necessarily stand with China on an issue. And so in his conclusion was, after attaching these qualitative establishing indicators and attaching qualitative amounts to each of them, he concluded that China has one-third the amount of soft power that the United States has. So there are definitely Chinese scholars who believe that China should be more proactive and work assiduously to catch up with the United States in soft power, but there's no agreement on what means should be used to achieve that goal. Now, finally, I want to end by talking a little bit about polling results that tell us something about Chinese soft power. After the U.S. invasion of Iraq, clearly the U.S. image around the world suffered. And about the same time, we started to see an uptick in polling of China's soft power around the world. China's image was seen as more positive. Now, I think this was in part because of the economic benefits that relations with China brought to many countries around the world. It is also possible that China benefited from the decline in U.S. soft power, in U.S. image around the world. Now, I would certainly say that there doesn't necessarily have to be a zero-sum relationship between U.S. and Chinese soft power. We could both possibly have a positive or negative image. But it's true, if you look in recent years, that the polling suggests that, in fact, they really have moved in opposite directions. And we can see that not only in the polls that show the decline in U.S. power and increase in Chinese image, but you see that again in more recent polls that now show the reverse trend, where the image of the United States is now seen as more positive and the image of China is somewhat weaker than it was. And I would cite, for example, the 2008 Chicago Council on Global Affairs survey on soft power in Asia. And there's also a very recent poll by the BBC that shows that U.S. image around the world has rebounded and attitudes towards China are less positive than they were a few years ago. To plug a recent report that CSIS produced and released a couple of weeks ago, similar findings were found in this study entitled Strategic Views on Asian Regionalism. And the study surveyed elites in 9 Asian countries and found that in every country other than China, China was seen as the most likely threat to peace and security 10 years from now. China was seen by every country by most of the countries as the most important power. But then when you ask the question which country is seen as a threat to peace and security, these are again elites in 9 countries in Asia expected that country would be China. So to sum up, for the Chinese leadership, cultural soft power is critically important, both domestically and increasingly in China's foreign policy. So far, China's objectives in employing soft power abroad are, I believe, primarily defensive and reactive. And as I indicated, recent polls suggest that China is really not making enduring long-term progress in advancing its objective of assuaging concerns that China will pose a threat. And this is particularly true in the region that's most important to China, which is its own neighborhood. Now, China's objectives could change in the future, of course. And the direction in which China's objectives might change could possibly be signaled by the debates over soft power among Chinese scholars. And so I will turn it over to Melissa to elaborate on those debates and some other aspects of our paper. Thank you.
Thanks, Bonnie. Yeah, as Bonnie mentioned, soft power is certainly a hot topic in China, and I think that we were frankly surprised by the sheer number of academic reports, newspaper articles, websites, and blogs that are devoted to this topic. And as Bonnie mentioned, it's important that this debate on soft power was sanctioned and encouraged by the Chinese leadership from its very beginning. Before discussing the details of the debate, I'd like to make a couple of points about what differentiates the Chinese discourse on soft power. What is it that makes soft power with Chinese characteristics? First, in contrast to Joseph Nye, who viewed soft power primarily as a means of improving the United States' international standing, the Chinese approach to soft power is holistic. And what I mean by that is that the domestic and foreign policy aspects of soft power are seen as equally important and conceived of as an organic whole. As one Chinese academic explains, establishing a harmonious society at home and a harmonious world abroad is seen as providing China with a comprehensive framework for the development of its soft power. And a second point that was interesting is that while ostensibly related to China's international standing and a foreign policy issue, the soft power discourse continues to be influenced and to influence the debate on China's domestic political and economic reform. A number of foreign policy scholars are actually highly critical of China's political reform, or the lack thereof, and view it as an obstacle to the expansion of China's soft power. For example, some scholars are boldly calling for the development of China's civil society, particularly truly independent Chinese NGOs, in order to improve China's soft power. So turning to the debate itself, There have been two waves of intellectual debate on soft power in China. In the 1990s, following publication of Joseph Nye's book, Bound to Lead, the debate remained largely theoretical and confined to academic circles. And the first Chinese scholar credited with publishing the first article is Wang Huning, who was an advisor to former President Jiang Zemin and is currently a member of the powerful secretariat of the party's Central Committee. And I think it's noteworthy that given the central role that has subsequently been accorded to culture, that back in the 1990s, Wang zeroed in on culture as being a state's most powerful soft power resource. But the discussion on soft power kind of really took off in China in the mid-2000s as it moved beyond academic circles to the wider public and also to the leadership. And given Nye's lukewarm reception to his theory in the United States, I think one question is, you know, why has it proved so popular in China? One possible explanation is that the theory resonates with Chinese traditional thinking. For example, Confucianism extols the kingly way over the hegemon's way. So this idea of soft and hard power was not unusual to Chinese. And another explanation is good timing. Nye's theory was introduced into China at a time that the country was undertaking an in-depth investigation into the rise and fall of great nations. This was being done not only to avoid the fate of the Soviet Union, but also to change China into a great country. Chinese intellectuals and the leadership were persuaded that in order to achieve, or more correctly, to regain China's great power status, it needed to build what they call comprehensive national power. And this includes both hard and soft power. They were also of the opinion that hard power, particularly military power, as an effective means of securing national interests, was on the decline, while the value of soft power was on the rise. So in this debate on soft power, two main schools of thought have emerged. The mainstream view, which is held by most of China's sociologists and philosophers, is that the core of soft power is culture. But there is a minority view, which is held by some of international relations experts, that there is the importance of culture, but they focus instead on how soft power resources are used, and they conclude that political power is the core of soft power. The culture school has had the greatest impact on policymaking, and as Bonnie mentioned, the Chinese leadership has embraced this central role of culture, which has resulted in expanded funding for cultural soft power activities at home and abroad. And I won't go into the details of the debate between the two schools as they're available in our report, but I think the important thing to note here is that this view of culture as being the most important source of a state's power and the core of soft power has been bolstered by Chinese observations of US soft power. The Chinese note that even as the Bush administration's pursuit of a unilateral foreign policy, the attempt to export democratic ideals, and the financial crisis have undermined some of America's other soft power resources, U.S. cultural soft power remains strong. I mean, even those who criticize U.S. foreign policy or U.S. political values still watch American movies, they drink Coke, and they go and eat at McDonald's. So a number of Chinese scholars really warn about the deficit in China's cultural trade with the West and have long called for using cultural mediums to improve China's image and enhance its profile on the international stage. This sort of debate really came to a head following Western media coverage of the events in Tibet last March and the Olympic torch relay. Anger over what was perceived by many Chinese as Western media bias revived long-standing suspicions in China that U.S. cultural hegemony was being used to weaken and destabilize China, and it led to calls for Beijing to address this challenge. So I think it's against this background that the announcement China intends to spend 45 billion yuan on expanding its media presence overseas comes as no surprise. Another thing that I think is of note is that this discourse on soft power is a common thread in the two major debates that continue to rage in China. One is on China's foreign policy, and one is on China's domestic policy. First, in foreign policy. In recent years, Chinese scholars have increasingly questioned the wisdom of adhering to Deng Xiaoping's dictum that China should keep a low profile in international affairs. Many are asking whether it's time for China to assume a more proactive posture commensurate with its rising status as an international power. And at the same time as this debate has intensified, concerns about China's rise, especially the development of its influence in the developing world, have fueled the China theory, as Bonnie talked about. The criticism of what the Chinese view as the expansion of its hard power, which includes economic investment, business ties, etc., in the developing world, is actually viewed by many Chinese scholars as undermining its attempt to expand soft power. To combat this increasingly negative image of China, a white paper was issued in 2005 on China's path to peaceful development. Then in August 2006, an unprecedented foreign affairs work conference was convened that gathered together all of China's top government, military, business, and policymakers. The key objective of the conference was to ensure that Beijing's external activities, especially in the developing world, rather than undermine these overall policy priorities. Notably, the conference reaffirmed Deng Xiaoping's guiding theory of keeping a low profile in the conduct of China's foreign policy, but it also recognized the importance of culture in foreign affairs and the promotion of soft power. Second, in this domestic debate, you know, in recent years, the downsides of the China economic miracle have become increasingly apparent. Income inequality, environmental degradation, corruption, and the social unrest that these have engendered. And this has really spurred a domestic debate among scholars about the future direction of China's economic and political reform. However, a number of foreign policy scholars have interjected themselves into this domestic debate by arguing that China's emphasis on economic hard power at home, particularly the lack of political reform, is undermining the development of its soft power both domestically and internationally. As one leading intellectual puts it, for China to be an inspiration to the world, first it needs to be an inspiration to its own people. So most of these scholars have actually backed the Hu Jintao, Wen Jiabao scientific development concept, which aims to balance this pursuit of economic growth, hard power, or material civilization, with paying equal attention to solving welfare issues. And also, they continue to press the leadership on political reform, in part to perfect what has become known as the China development model. And again, I won't go into the details of the specifics of the discourse. It's in our paper. But again, the important thing to note here that on the discourse on the China development model, it's the point at which this larger ongoing debate about China's foreign policy posture, the debate about the future direction of China's economic and political reform, and the promotion of soft power all come together. Chinese scholars are currently debating whether the China development model could or should be exported, whether Chinese values should be promoted as an alternative to Western values. They're asking whether China should deliberately use its soft power to promote its influence, and how would these efforts affect the US-China bilateral relationship? According to our research, mainstream scholars, many remain skeptical about the very existence of a China development model, let alone its universality. But their other main point is that a development model should not be propagated, because this will only add further fuel to the fears of China's rise. And during an interview, one senior Chinese official very pointedly told us, and I quote, "China will never try to export a development model." So mainstream academic and leadership opinion currently holds that the primary purpose of China's soft power is defensive, not offensive. And they believe that China's soft power promotion should remain reactive, not proactive. It should be aimed at countering the China threat theory and improving China's image abroad. However, a minority view does assert that the China model could and should be exported. In particular, in the wake of the financial crisis, a number of scholars are beginning to question the infallibility of the US development model and do believe that the China model has something to offer the world. So these scholars are really beginning to push for a more proactive soft power policy moving forward. In conclusion, I think the point is that as China expands its national power and assumes a more larger role on the international stage, this debate on soft power in China will likely revolve around how to perfect the China model domestically through economic and political reform. Whether this model should be exported internationally, whether China's soft power should remain reactive or should it become more proactive, and what impact any change in focus would have on the Sino-US relationship. And so I think this is what we need to watch moving forward. Thanks.
Thank you, Bonnie and Melissa. We have time for a few quick questions. So please, if you could identify yourself and your institution, we'll open the floor.
Liu Liu, Voice of America. When you were doing your study in China, did you ask the question whether it's even possible to project soft power in an effective way when political reform is lacking and the government is repressive? Are these things talked a lot about, you know, by the officials? And what are their main views? Thanks.
Yeah, actually, you know, this, as I said, most of my research focuses on the domestic debate, so I was frankly surprised that how bold foreign policy scholars and even some of the officials we spoke to are in talking about the lack of, you know, soft power in China domestically. By that, they mean the lack of good corporate governance, the rule of law, political system reform. And I think that they are definitely trying to pressure the government by, you know, using soft power as the end and the need for political reform as the means to get there. And so in a way they have more leeway, whereas domestic political scholars, for them political reform is the end and it's a much more delicate subject. But yes, I mean, the lack of political reform, you know, the problems of corruption and stuff, that came up a lot in our discussions.
This is a topic that came up in the original CSIS Smart Power Commission, but on the reverse, and looking at how the United States handles its affairs at home and how that is a projection of its soft power. And what was pointed to us in numerous conversations and interviews is how the U.S. government handled Katrina, Guantanamo Bay, a lot of how we are upholding our own ideals sends a signal, and I think that's certainly the case with China as well as it moves forward. Other questions, sir? Right.
My name is Ahmed Mir, retired Foreign Service. It seems to me that China seems to be doing very well internationally through its industrial development. I think that is resulting in soft power, the tremendous respect China is gaining for its achievements. And the second thing that seems to me very important, having served in the Far East, that Confucianism seems to be the biggest soft power that China has, the tremendous respect for Chinese culture all the way from Korea, Japan, and Southeast Asia. I can sympathize with the Chinese perspective that if they push their soft power, they will get a very strong reaction from the world's leading communities and the West.
My name is Yang Huan Keo at Georgetown University as a visiting scholar. Now, in your survey, both Bonnie and Melissa, did you get the impression of what China means by culture? I mean, Confucianism, heritage and value orientation all came up here in the question by previous previous questioner. But if I may, this is my question I'd like to hear more about. Your impression of what China means by culture and power. Now, 10 years ago, I was in a meeting in Beijing. It was sponsored by Fulbright Commission and Foreign Affairs College of Beijing. And I was, I remember, since I was a Fulbright exchange professor in Seoul and invited to that conference, that the Chinese were very much against or critical of Zhou Enlai as an author of, let's say, 100,000 U.S. troops to be maintained in East Asia following the end of the Cold War. And I'm glad to hear that China now gives more a kind of a support to Bound to Lead book, among others, and also a book, Soft Power for the United States. But my impression at that time was that what happened in between is China's rise, economic rise, as a superpower, and therefore what assurance and guarantee is there that the next 10 or 20 years China will move beyond what they are talking about, as you have reported in your discussion this morning. Thank you.
We're going to take one more question and then and put them together. So, sir? Right here.
Thank you. Leonard Oberlander, independent consultant. In looking at the methods of assessing soft power, on the one hand, I hear it sometimes being described as projecting power, almost in the sense of proselytizing. And other times, it's thought of as projecting power in terms of information, such as the institutes. The institutes don't appear to be proselytizing as much as they are informing to help, or at least the goal is to help other nations, other cultures understand with whom they are dealing. And in the structure of looking at soft power and political power and assessing it, sometimes it seems you're looking at a static model of political power and also cultural, and looking at that snapshot and assessing it. At other times, it's clear that Chinese see the cultural power as evolving, and they say people have to accept political power. People have to become more sophisticated in understanding political power through the culture, so that therefore they can evolve and into a greater rule of law and an enhanced status of checks and balances and so forth. So if you're looking at a dynamic model, it's if you're assessing it in terms of feedback from culture to politics, power, and then from politics to culture, an example being the Ministry of Culture angering the foreign ministry, as Bonnie said earlier, by being credited with the idea. Isn't that a development of checks and balances, in a sense, moving and advancing sort of a democratic thought? So the question really is, in this instance, are we assessing what what Chinese government and culture are doing in a dynamic model with feedback, planning, and then evaluation, feeding back to the planning, feeding back into evaluation? Or are we looking at a photograph and perhaps missing some of the effects of its transition?
Thank you. Bonnie, do you want to...
Okay. Complicated question, not much time to answer, so I'm just going to make a few very brief comments. My own view is that an absence of coordination describes more accurately the situation in China rather than checks and balances. I do think that in many ways China remains a sort of stovepipe system. There really is a lack of coordination on many issues. It's much better than it was 10 or 20 years ago. There's a lot more horizontal interaction and discussion across agencies, but there are still many issues where decisions are made absolutely at the highest levels of leadership. I don't particularly see the emergence of checks and balances. I wanted to comment on the previous question by the visiting fellow from Georgetown University. I think that there are different views in China regarding culture and what culture is. For example, we had a conversation with a diplomat who is in charge of culture at the Chinese embassy here. And one of his comments was really his job is to promote the arts. Really not culture. He's promoting Chinese arts, you know, museum exhibits and cultural troops and things of that nature. But he said, in his view, it's not really culture. Culture, I think, to many people in China is really it's the traditional values and certainly Confucianism, the various religions in China, Taoism, Buddhism. But I think that the important thing here is that China does have a pattern of integrating what it sees as the best of the East and the West. And so I would expect that over time, we will see China's own concept of culture continue to evolve.
Thank you. We're going to take one more question from the woman right here.
Thanks. My name is Elisa Prosperetti, CSIS Africa Program. I was wondering what the implications were for Chinese soft power in terms of youth culture. Because when I think of soft power, American soft power, what comes to mind immediately are hip-hop stars or Levi's jeans or whatever it may be. And especially with regard to the youth bulge in the developing world, where do you think that China has an attractive force for young people around the world?
Frankly, I mean, this discussion didn't really, you know, come up during our research, but you know, I think this is the big question, that China's putting so many resources into expanding its culture overseas, but really will it get traction? You know, I suppose that Chinese movies are popular, you know, kung fu, the martial arts and things like that, but you know, this is what I think we need to look to assess moving forward. With all the resources they're putting into it and this emphasis on culture, will people really turn on CCTV rather than CNN? So, you know, this is something that we need to watch. And that's the big question, whether or not really this emphasis on culture is going to pay off.
If I could just add one short point. I really like your question. I wish I had more of an understanding of Chinese youth. I'm not sure, for example, how popular Chinese music is in Asia. I think it's fairly popular in Taiwan, but I don't know if it's popular in other countries. But if we look at just one example of how China's youth and is being applied to the soft power effort in other countries, we can see that now China has launched an effort to establish something akin to our Peace Corps program, which they call, I think it's the Chinese Volunteers, and they're now sending people either before or after college. They're providing this opportunity for Chinese youth to go abroad, to interact more, help people in the developing world, and share with those countries their own sort of sense of what Chinese culture is about from a youth's perspective. So I think that's an interesting example of how the youth are being used in promoting China's soft power abroad.
Please join me in thanking Bonnie and Melissa for a very interesting discussion. And we're going to have a quick changing of the table, and we'll start in session two in a few minutes. We're moving into this session now, looking at the role of China in the developing world, and in particular how China is using its soft power in these regions and what the implications are for the United States currently and looking down the road. As the gentleman from Georgetown mentioned, a lot of the concern about China not necessarily is what's going on today, but what might be happening in 10, 20 years and the political influence that it might be gaining and what that means for the United States down the road. We asked our most senior scholars here at CSIS to do research in their region of expertise, and to some traveled to their region, did first-person interviews, literature surveys, and we have really four terrific papers in our report. John Alterman will start. He is the director of our Middle East program. Catherine Bliss is our deputy director of the Americas program. Jennifer Cook directs our Africa program, and Brian Harding is a research associate in the Southeast Asia program. He co-wrote the paper with Derek Mitchell, who directs that program. So we're going to go in that order, alphabetical order, and there are some common themes and some differences among the regions, and I hope that you guys will draw those out, and we'll have some time for Q&A. Thank you. John?
Good morning. When I lived in Cairo in the early 90s, there was this really strange restaurant called Fuxing. And Fuxing was on the second floor of a building. It sort of looked like nobody had renovated it in several decades. And the strange thing was there was one of the only Chinese restaurants in Cairo, and they used to write your bill transliterating the Chinese into Arabic. It was this weird place, and the owner was this Chinese guy whose family had left China in 1950 or something and had come to Egypt as refugees, so the owner spoke unaccented Egyptian Arabic as well as Chinese. And China in the Middle East was kind of like that in the early 90s. It was this weird thing. There were little pockets of people. It was cut off from China in lots of ways. It was just dislocated. It was a pocket of oddity in the Middle East. About 3 years ago, in Dubai, they opened Dragon Mart. Dragon Mart stretches a kilometer. It is a wholesale warehouse for all kinds of vendors from all over China to sell their goods to all over the Middle East. The idea of China being something strange, something distant, something remote, pockets of oddities, that's not the way China is in the Middle East anymore. China in the Middle East has gone from this oddity to being this incredible engine of innovation, of opportunity. The way that American investors have seen China as a locus of opportunity is a place where Middle Eastern investors have seen China as a locus of opportunity. And I think time and time and time again, you see curiosity about China, activity by China, and growing interaction between the two. In fact, one of the frustrations that Chinese have expressed to me in the Middle East is we're trying to develop trading relationships, and we know everything we can sell. We can't figure out what to buy from these guys. And they're frustrated on the Chinese side that, in fact, they can't develop the relationship as much as the people on the Middle East side want to develop the relationship. I enjoyed this project. It got me to Algeria, which is a place where you think is sort of irrelevant to China, but actually is quite interesting. And then Egypt, a place that I've lived off and on for many years, where Chinese activity is growing. And what this gave me an opportunity to see is what actually are Chinese doing in the Middle East, and how are Middle Easterners responding to China? I also was able to do this after I had done a study that came out in June called The Vital Triangle, about the U.S., China, and the Middle East. And I had been to China several times and worked with Chinese scholars to understand how they see China's evolving engagement with the Middle East. So it was something that taught me something about places I knew, taught me something about places I didn't know, and helped me to contextualize what the Chinese are up to. Just to pick up on some of the themes of the earlier panel, it seems to me that from a Chinese perspective, they look at the Middle East and they get the heebie-jeebies. Right, what they do in the Middle East, they see in China as fundamentally defensive. They import about half their oil from the Middle East. They look at their oil, at their energy needs over the next 2-3 decades. They say their energy needs are going to grow. And where is the locus of proven reserves of oil in the world? The fact is, a huge amount of it's in the Middle East. So they feel that they're sort of tied to this region. It's a region they don't feel they really understand. It's a region where they have limited ties. It's a region they feel Americans really do understand. and Americans have all these troops there. So what do you do? And I think that, actually the Middle East keeps them up at night. There's a sense that, a lot of Chinese have expressed that the U.S., or expressed to me, that the U.S. has locked up a lot of the oil in the world. Right? U.S. oil companies, ExxonMobil, all these guys, they have the oil, so they have to be surfing around in Sudan, they have to be dealing with the Iranians, because the U.S. has all the good stuff locked up in its existing relationships. They also express this consistent view, when I was talking to people in Beijing, that the United States will use China's dependence on the Middle East as a way to pressure China when the time comes to pressure China diplomatically. That the first thing the U.S. will do to pressure China, in what Chinese said, was cut off our access to oil, cut off the Straits of Malacca, something, you know, something that, this long supply chain and China's reliance on the United States not only to secure the Gulf but also to secure the sea lanes that go between the Gulf and China is a consistent vulnerability for China, for which they have to compensate in lots and lots of ways. The other thing that, became apparent is, in contrast to this Chinese unease with the reliance on the Middle East, is this Chinese comfort with the status quo in the Middle East. Now, I'm old enough to remember when China would support any revolutionary organization that came along in the Middle East, and the liberation thing of this, and the liberation of that, and the freedom fighters of this, right? And the Middle East had all these little wacky movements, and, they had ties to China. Well, China's not supporting wacky little movements in the Middle East. China's extremely comfortable with the status quo. It's extremely comfortable with authoritarian governments. It has a policy of non-interference. It's the United States that starts thinking about how we might change the, status quo in the Middle East, how we might provoke positive change. You never hear Chinese talking about provoking positive change. And I actually found when I talked to Middle East experts in China, they were reluctant to talk about processes of social and political change in the Middle East for fear that people would think that they're actually just talking about China and that's not really something you should talk about. So there were, almost blinders among Chinese Middle East experts to a lot of the things that drive much of the scholarship in the United States, a sense that China has that they're very happy casting their lot with the existing governments in the region and using the American impatience with governments, the American desire to evolve these into some higher form of democratic, liberal, I don't know what, as a calling card for China to differentiate itself from the United States when it deals with governments in the Middle East. That's not to say that China has any interest in confronting the United States in the Middle East. In fact, China benefits from the security structure that the U.S. establishes in the Middle East. Right? In many ways, they're freeloading. Right? I had a Chinese embassy official tell me in a, sort of a rare and completely uncontrolled moment, because some of the young guys aren't as well controlled as the older guys. And he looked at me and he said, "How about you do security, we do business?" Right? And I think for the young guys, that's what they want to do, right? They say the Americans will do all the nasty stuff and we'll clean up the profits. A lot of Chinese action shows up in strange ways. And one of the things that, I found really striking, the reason I went to Algeria, has something between 30 and 40,000 Chinese workers. Now, here's a country that has high unemployment, no place for university graduates to go. What are you doing importing Chinese labor? Well, they're importing lots of Chinese labor. China has $17 billion worth of project financing in Saudi Arabia. They're building two-thirds of a road that stretches from the border with Morocco to the border with Tunisia. $17 billion in project finance. They're bringing in the Chinese workers because they say the Chinese workers will do work, and they don't take a lot of money. And they don't agitate about politics. And that's what we need. We don't need to create more problems. We're getting the job done. And we're getting the job done cheaply. So they're building roads. They're building housing. Right? They're doing some little trading on the side. Sometimes people get upset because they have pigs in the backyard. And, you know, it creates a little bit of tension. But there's a sense that China creates a service by providing goods, providing infrastructure at a lower price than they can get having Algerians build it themselves. So there's a desire to bring in China. Bilateral trade between Algeria and China increased from $290 million in 2001 to $4 billion last year. This is a budding relationship. It seems to me that in many ways China is more eager to expand this relationship than Algeria is. It's very hard to study Chinese in Algeria. The Chinese keep saying, well, how about letting us set up Chinese classes? And the Algerians say, we'll get back to you. If the great thing for, you know, I have dealt with enough people who've worked with Chinese bureaucrats that they say, Chinese bureaucrats are, you know, because I deal with Egyptian bureaucrats, and bureaucrats all over are something special. But what's really lovely is when Chinese diplomats complain about the tediousness of the bureaucracy in Algeria, right? We just need to get something done, and we can't get it done. And there's really a sense that, the Algerians are holding this relationship back. And that, I think, is something that frustrates the Chinese, limits the relationship, but is certainly where the dynamics are, is China is interested in expanding, and the Algerians don't really want them. Egypt is in the stage where Egypt, I think, is very eager to expand. Egypt just opened an elementary school with instruction in Chinese. They're going to open one in each province, each of the 29 provinces of Egypt. At 87 places in the first class, 1,500 applicants. There is a sense that China is the future. If you can speak Chinese, you're going to have a job, and a job in Egypt is a really important thing to have. As I said, the problem in Egypt is that the Chinese can't figure out what to buy from the Egyptians. They know what to sell. They'll sell all the cheap manufactured goods to Egypt, but they can't figure out what to buy. They buy oranges, they buy marble, alabaster, but, you know, they're like, there's nothing to buy. But they're still, they're expanding into universities, they're teaching Chinese. In many ways, and the strange thing is, they're doing what we have done for a half century. Language classes, getting people used to it, you try to build tourism, travel. They send a few hundred people from the Arab world to China to study every year. Instructions in English, because they don't expect people to learn Chinese. They have, I mean, we heard at the end of the last panel about a sort of Peace Corps. A lot of Chinese provinces have standing cooperative agreements where they twin with countries. So I forget, there's a province that twins with Algeria, Xinjiang something. And they send, I could get the number wrong. Don't quote me. I think it's in the paper, though. I think 140 doctors, maybe they have sent 140 doctors to Algerian hospitals. They just have these existing exchange programs. They get people out there. They engage because they feel Chinese should see the rest of the world. The rest of the world should see China. There's a sense of a broader kinds of engagement. They published this magazine. This is the Arabic edition of China Today. It's actually a decent magazine. I'm kind of impressed. It's much better quality than many Egyptian magazines. It's published in Cairo. I met with their staff. It's got pictures of China, and it has a feature about this Egyptian guy who travels to China and what he sees. It's from a coffee shop on a Chinese street is what his column is called. They have a really interesting column called Kulina Sharq, which means we're all Eastern, or we're all from the East, which sort of stresses that, you know, there's this Western stuff, right, and that's them, and then there's us, and we're really like you, right? We have a lot of the same problems. We start from a lot of the same premises, and it tries to sort of get this idea out there that the differences aren't as stark as people might think. This is a magazine that circulates about 15,000 copies a month. 10,000 of those go to Egypt. Good use of money? I don't know. The U.S. put out a magazine that was even slicker than this called High after September 11th. We published a lot more copies, and we stopped because it was stupid. But we try to do the magazine publishing thing. We try to do the exchange thing. I mean, the Chinese in many ways are taking the pages right out of our book, doing it at a much lower level of effort than we have. And I think that partly, you know, they don't need to win this game. China's not seeking to become everybody's favorite country in the world. They're not seeking to become the most powerful country in the world, at least not in the Middle East in the current time frame. I think what they're trying to do is they're trying to become kind of like a Walmart, which is you take markets that nobody else thinks are worth anything, and you figure out a way to serve them cheaply, and you put in some effort, and you build and you build and you build, and you have your niche. Walmart's not a market maker. Right? China doesn't seek in the Middle East to displace the United States. Quite the contrary. China seeks to profit from the structure the U.S. establishes in the region, establishing itself as a low-cost, somewhat lower-quality complement for people who might not want the United States. Makes an awful lot of sense for China. Makes an awful lot of sense for a number of countries in the Middle East who either want to improve their bargaining position vis-a-vis the United States or supplement the relationship with the United States. It seems to me that the challenge in all of this isn't keeping China out of the Middle East. I don't think there's a way to keep China out of the Middle East. Certainly with its energy dependence, it's going to feel more and more drawn into the Middle East. But instead, the challenge for the United States is how do you draw China in such a way that it reinforces U.S. interests rather than undermines them? How do you keep China from being the alternative to the United States? A position which I think many Middle Eastern countries are much more interested in than China is. As I say, the Chinese desire is, how about you guys do security, we do business? That won't work. And I think the challenge for us is how do we create a role for how do we align our interests with China in the region in such a way that they reinforce our common interests rather than create a sort of competition between the two that undermines our common interests in the goal of trying to defeat the other. Thank you.
Thanks, John. Catherine? China knows, it's not unlike Egypt, China knows what it wants to buy in Latin America, and let's talk a little bit about how that's going.
Yes. Thank you. China's relationship with countries of the Americas is characterized by pursuing recognition that it is the legitimate representative of China in international venues, securing acquisition of raw materials for its industrial needs, gaining access to regional markets for the sale of its manufactured goods, and deepening alliances in international political and trade fora. China uses the tools of soft power, including language training, cultural exchanges, tourism promotion, scientific cooperation, technical assistance, and academic fellowships for students to solidify its relationships with countries in the Americas, to deepen its influence, and to ensure access to markets and materials. Now, Chinese economic activity in the Americas actually dates to the era of Iberian colonialism in the 16th century, when Spanish fleets brought goods from Asia through their territories in the New World before moving them on to Europe. Immigration from China to the Americas dates to the middle of the 19th century, when male laborers were brought from China to the region to work in agriculture and railroad construction. By the 1930s, Chinese restaurants, or cafés chinos, in Mexico City were among the most popular hangouts for gangsters and members of the underworld. By the 1960s, well, most governments of the region actually formalized diplomatic ties with the People's Republic of China in the 1970s. But Cuba was the first nation in the hemisphere to recognize China. In a show of solidarity for a fellow revolutionary nation, the Castro regime established ties with China in 1960, declaring that it was severing its ties with Taiwan and recognizing its socialist ally instead. Chile, under the Popular Unity regime, recognized China in 1970, becoming the first South American country to do so. Over the next few years, many other regional governments followed suit, including right-wing military regimes, such as in Brazil. These states recognized China and affirmed their acknowledgement that Tibet is part of China. However, several decades of diplomatic relations with many of the region's most populous and economically strategic countries have not convinced Paraguay and 11 Central American and Caribbean nations to shift their recognition from Taiwan and acknowledge the People's Republic. Now, while securing recognition for its sovereignty is a key political concern of China's, the country's principal interest in the Americas appears to be economic. China views the region's natural resource abundance as important to its potential for continued economic growth and development. At the same time, China sees the region's growing and increasingly prosperous population as a potential market for its finished products. trade between China and the countries of the Americas has grown considerably since the 1990s, but trade flows and investment patterns are uneven, with some commodity-exporting countries such as Chile and Peru benefiting greatly from China's hunger for copper in recent years, while Mexico and the Central American countries view the influx of inexpensive manufactured goods as competition and a threat to their economic interests. Securing observer status in intergovernmental processes in the Americas, such as the Organization of American States and the Economic Commission on Latin America and the Caribbean, has helped China develop a more nuanced understanding of political, economic, and security concerns in the hemisphere. Now, public diplomacy efforts to acquaint citizens of the Americas with its language, culture, and society play an important role in China's work to strengthen ties with the region. China's cultural outreach includes language instruction, teacher and student exchanges, the establishment of cultural institutes, sister city programs, and traveling art, film, and historical exhibitions. And these are not new. They seem to have developed considerably in recent years, but in 1986, Peru and China signed a cultural agreement providing for the exchange of students and practices regarding cultural heritage protection. By 2008, this had expanded to include a series of agreements on economics, technology, cultural exchange, medical quarantine, and media relations. In anticipation of the 2008 Olympics in Beijing, the Chinese government contributed to the construction of a Casa de Beijing in São Paulo, Brazil. And this opened on August 8th, just as the Olympics were getting underway, and provides a venue for martial arts instruction, film and art exhibitions, and educational activities. Between 2006 and 2008, Venezuela and China had formalized a cultural exchange program, which featured shared arts, film, literature, and music activities. Now, the effort to bolster popular awareness of China's language, politics, and society in the Americas has intensified thanks to the inauguration of university-based Confucius Institutes over the last 4 years. In Canada, there are now at least 5 Confucius Institutes. And in 2006, China and Mexico celebrated the opening of the first Confucius Institute in Latin America at the Chinese Cultural Institute in Mexico City, with a second center opening in 2007 in the state of Nuevo León in Monterrey. China now maintains institutes in Colombia and Peru, with plans for new institutes in Argentina, Cuba, and Chile. The China Scholarship Council oversees a wide range of educational activities worldwide, and in 2007 recruited 10,000 students and scholars to study in China. And the CSC has formal recruiting agreements with ministries and universities in Brazil, Colombia, Cuba, Dominica, Mexico, Peru, and Venezuela. Cuba and China have held periodic educational dialogues and exchanges since establishing diplomatic relations in the 1960s, and in 2001, the two countries formalized a bilateral agreement on education. In 2003, the Chinese embassy in Mexico reported that the two countries had held 5 meetings regarding education exchange, and that China had sent 18 professors to Mexico to teach at the Colegio de México and the Universidad Nacional Autónoma de México. Now, beyond education, China uses tourism, cultural exchanges, and media outreach to foster ties of solidarity and understanding between Chinese citizens and those from Latin America. Since 2003, China has formalized tourism agreements with Cuba, Argentina, Mexico, Brazil, Chile, Peru, and Venezuela, designating them approved destinations for Chinese travelers. Having approved destination status means that Chinese tourists are permitted to undertake leisure travel to that destination using approved tourism groups. And there are also, similarly, 50 sister city exchanges between municipalities in China and those in the Americas. Finally, scientific and technical cooperation activities form a key component of China's outreach to Latin America and involve both government and the private sector. In 1993, Brazil and China announced a strategic relationship to foster trade, science, and technical exchanges and cultural ties, with China providing the CBERS-1 and 2 satellites to Brazil for remote sensing purposes. And in May 2007, China and Cuba agreed to cooperate in the areas of biotechnology and biomedical sciences. Now, popular attitudes towards China in the context of these people-to-people, social, scientific, and cultural exchanges seem to be mixed. Polling in the run-up to the 2008 Summer Olympics suggested that residents in Latin America maintain fairly favorable views of China and the Chinese people. According to Pew Global Attitude polls taken in 2007 and 2008, the percentage of those who view China favorably in Brazil and Mexico fell over the one-year period, while it rose slightly in Argentina. The June 2007 survey showed that Mexicans and Brazilians were divided on whether or not they believed China respects their country's point of view, and a significant minority in Mexico reported believing that China had replaced the United States as the world's leading superpower. In all three countries, those polled believe China's growing military profile has negative implications for the region, while China's growing economic power was viewed positively by Brazilians and Argentines, but not by Mexicans. More research needs to be done on the extent to which Chinese business practices or popular perceptions of Chinese economic activities affect domestic politics, but population concerns over environment, health, and labor issues seem to loom large in the region. For example, in Peru, where the Chinese company Chinalco has gained influence in the copper mining sector, the company's plan to relocate the town of Morococha in order to expand extraction activities at the Mount Toromocho mine has created tensions, as some residents consider the compensation package offered by the company to be too small. Concerns over tainted products from China have also raised tensions in Central America, where cough syrup containing a Chinese origin component that contained diethylene glycol killed more than 300 patients in Panama in 2006. So in summary, China uses its diplomatic, cultural, and military relations in the Americas to secure political recognition and advantageous trade and investment conditions. Aggressive scale-up of cultural activities, language training, and educational exchanges may enhance Chinese understanding of and ease of movement within Latin American societies in the long term, but in the short term, relations may continue to be somewhat limited by cultural difference and lack of communication. Given concerns about food and product safety, it may be helpful for countries in the region to initiate exchanges on product safety, perhaps through the APEC Health Working Group or APEC Food Systems Networks in which relevant countries participate. Bilateral mechanisms, such as the Strategic Economic Dialogue or the 10-year plan, as well as the U.S.-China Global Issues Forum, may be used to explore links between natural resource extraction and conservation and reinforce a dialogue on environmental stewardship and overseas economic activities. Finally, it may be helpful to organize joint exchanges related to culture or science cooperation on a regional basis, perhaps under the auspices of the Organization of American States. Thank you.
Thanks, Catherine. Jennifer.
Great. Thanks very much. First, let me say I think the jury is still out on whether China's soft power strategies are gaining traction in Africa, but it's definitely a shifting picture. China is not new in Africa. I think everyone knows that. But in the most recent decade, it has expanded dramatically, driven primarily by the growth of the Chinese economy and the requirements for energy sources, mineral sources, and I think further-looking export markets looking into the future. And I think this rapid expansion has provoked a range of reactions, both in Africa and in the West. A lot of the data, the survey data shows that generally African views of China are quite positive, and in a sampling of countries, not all countries, shows that positive perceptions of China's influence in the world are gaining on and in some cases surpassing positive views of the United States, whether that's due to perhaps a U.S. decline and shooting itself in the foot on some of our domestic Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib unilateralism in the past 8 years. I think that's played very strongly in African opinion circles. But no doubt that China is gaining ground in this area. In Africa, I think these reactions are sometimes fueled by hopes for what China can do for Africa in terms of trade, investment, alternative development, partnerships and leverage, solidarity in international fora on matters of interest to the developing world. And in some parts, I think also by fears of what the seemingly insatiable need for resources and energy might mean for very fragile economies, for weak governments, and in many cases for marginalized or voiceless populations. I think in the West, again, there's this fear that China's economic engagement and its increasing soft power engagement may undermine ultimately U.S. influence and undermine our investments or the West's investments in good governance and transparency and accountability issues. But there's also, I think, a growing acknowledgement that China may be meeting many of the needs and aspirations of Africans that the West in recent years has neglected, things like agriculture and infrastructure and trade and investment, things that actually are priorities for many Africans above some of perhaps the humanitarian and security assistance that the United States has been most focused on. I'd say that China's soft power in Africa, well, let me just say that, you know, trade and investment, I'm still a little unclear if it's soft power or hard power. I gather it gets called sticky power sometimes. I think beyond simply the actual trade and investment of China in Africa, I think China's willingness to trade with Africa and the risks, the willingness to engage in that way, in ways that I think a lot of U.S. businesses have been very wary of doing, very risk-averse. China going out and making these deals is seen fundamentally as more optimistic towards Africa's eventual future. And I think it was Mr. Amir who said, you know, much, I think, of China's soft power lies in the attraction of this very dynamic economy, the model that it's showing. And many African countries would rather hitch their wagon to this burgeoning economy than to that of the West. It's just seen as a much bigger opportunity. And I wonder if the financial meltdown here in the United States has somewhat undermined our attraction in that regard. So trade is certainly growing. Obviously, most in the big energy producers, Angola, Nigeria, Sudan, South Africa is another big partner, but in other places as well beyond the energy sector, and that's something I think that the United States can learn a lot from, and I'll talk more about that in a bit. A second area is its investments in infrastructure, in roads, in railroads, in ports, in public buildings, again, things that ultimately are going to be the catalyst for African economic growth, and an area, again, where the United States, the World Bank, and the West in general has walked away from over a number of years. Now, these aren't grants to these countries, and ultimately the countries will pay for those, whether in resources, in mortgaging future resources, or paying back loans and so forth. But they're very clearly branded as Chinese, since primarily it's Chinese workers who are building them. So it's a very visible, tangible sign of China's presence and what it's doing for African states. And I think many Africans appreciate that, although the ultimate costs of those may not be clear to the average citizen who's seeing the road go up. And a number of Africans over the years have said, you know, I'd rather have a road to get my food from my village to the market than, you know, a lecture about human rights and democracy and so forth. This is what I need first and foremost. But going along with this broad economic engagement, I think is the rhetoric of sovereignty, respect for sovereignty, which obviously for a number of reasons resonates with African governments who would just as soon not have people interfere with how they do their domestic business. But in fact, it resonates to a certain extent with segments of the population who say, look, you know, we're a sovereign country. Don't lecture to us. Don't patronize us. And they can see U.S. lectures on democracy as hypocritical or interfering or patronizing generally. Second, the rhetoric of solidarity. And if you have traveled to Beijing last year, and virtually every conversation, whether it was with students or government or business people across the board, would kind of start with the long history of China's engagement and the admiral who sailed around the coast and who never colonized or took a slave and so forth. That's really part of the narrative of China's engagement there. The support for liberation movements, particularly in southern Africa, support for the ANC, support for ZANU-PF in Zimbabwe, back in the days of liberation. So that history is very much played upon, and the idea of China as a fellow developing country, even though obviously the differences are fairly stark in some ways. And then the rhetoric of win-win. This was, everybody would say win-win to the point at the end of the trip we would all cheer with win-win at the end of at the bars. But that sense of partnership and that we're not doing this out of the charity of our hearts, we have our interests too, is actually appealing because it means that that partnership is going to be sustained because it's from interest versus humanitarian or security engagement, which can change with the vagaries of popular constituencies here or money and so forth. And I think, again, that's quite appealing to African audiences. This kind of rhetoric is wrapped in significant diplomatic outreach. You have the biannual forum on Chinese-African cooperation, major event, whether in Beijing, this year it will be in Cairo, big red carpet, you know, every visit by a China, by an African leader gets, you know, really gets feted within Beijing. You know, here I talked to the Liberian defense minister, said, I'm lucky if I can get a meeting at the State Department in China. They just roll out the red carpet, and I feel like I'm king for the day. So that's important. The travel of Chinese leadership to countries, and not just the big partners, Angola, Nigeria, but to the countries that may be, seem of less strategic significance. I think that's very important from a perception point of view. Even in areas of kind of harder power and peacekeeping, China often takes the less controversial, intrusive form. Most of their peacekeepers in Africa are engineers, for example, so that they can fulfill their commitment to be constructive in peacekeeping but not really get into any kind of political tension there. Finally, there's an expansion of small businesses and individual businessmen in Africa, and I think that's something to watch in terms of soft power. Many are kind of in enclaves in the big cities, very natural for kind of a newly immigrant, you know, communities. But I think that's something to watch how eventually that plays out. Also, though, you'll find small Chinese businesses in very remote African villages, you know, just a shop selling commercial goods. And I think that's a trend perhaps to watch and to examine further. China's soft power in Africa, it's not fixed in stone, and it's going to shift and adapt. I think the trick for China is figuring out to which audience is it targeting its soft power. It has a number of audiences there. It has the international community, and it wants to portray itself as a responsible stakeholder, and it can get a lot of flack as the Darfur and the so-called genocide Olympics proved. It needs to play to that audience. It needs to play to government audiences who are its key partners so far. But also in African countries that are democratizing, and there are other voices within society that matter as much and sometimes more than the particular government in power. And China's has not, I don't think, figured out how to engage with civil society and those non-governmental actors in countries, and it's going to have to learn to do that, as the United States has tried to do over the years with varying success. In a number of places, those kind of groups have pushed back on China's engagement. So in South Africa, the labor unions really pushed their government to negotiate voluntary quotas on the import of textiles from China. In Gabon, which is not a particularly democratic country, environmental groups really pushed their government to push back on the Sinopec, which is signing agreements in a park reserve, hadn't done the due diligence on the environmental impacts, and eventually had to leave the area. In Zambia, the minor safety issues became a big issue. China's engagement became an election issue in Zambia and played a critical role. In global trade issues, I think China positions itself as in solidarity with African countries, but there are divergences of interest there that ultimately Africans are going to have to grapple with as well. I hope I'm not going on too long, but we were asked to say a little bit about implications for U.S. Soft power. And I think, you know, this all comes at a time when U.S. engagement in Africa has been expanding pretty dramatically as well, with PEPFAR, the AIDS program, malaria, AFRICOM, the Millennium Challenge account, and so forth. I think there's a perception in some areas that, okay, this is some strategic battle for the hearts and minds of Africans. I would say it's, you know, in a return to the Cold War and or kind of mentality. I think Africa today is very different than it was in the Cold War, largely because of these multiple voices with whom you have to deal. So I think much more will hinge on the African response to this competition than to any one partner. I think for the U.S. has a big opportunity to engage with China in a lot of these endeavors, kind of encourage and collaborate on those aspects that, you know, play to its role as a responsible stakeholder. There's opportunities in health, I think in agriculture, which will likely figure in the upcoming FOCAC. In peacekeeping, there are already kind of de facto collaboration and cooperation in some areas on peacekeeping. And a whole other range of areas. So that's with China. Within Africa, I think we can learn from China that we've been missing the boat a little bit on the trade and investment side in terms of investing, and we're not likely to do it in the Chinese way, but how do we better invest in infrastructure, in power generation, in transportation, and so forth, things that, that Africans have said are priorities to us. The Millennium Challenge Account, I think, is an excellent innovation, and almost every compact signed with Africa has a major infrastructure component, and those are compacts that are essentially designed by the African countries. So that should tell us this is a priority for Africans, and I think we need to respond better to African set priorities in ways that the China win-win strategy, I think, does well. Finally, I think we need to continue to help strengthen the voice, the capacity, and the technical expertise of those other voices in society, whether civil society, environmental groups, legislatures, and business community, and so forth, to help effectively manage and oversee the deals done, the negotiations cut with China, kind of balancing the costs the short-term and long-term costs and benefits. That's not just directed at China. There's a number of new players coming into Africa at this time, and I think what we want to try to do is bolster our African capacities to manage that kind of competition in a way that will ultimately benefit the majority of citizens. So I'll end there.
Thank you. Much has been made over China's emergence as a major power in Southeast Asia over the last 15 years, and basically for good reason. Politically, it's assuaged regional concerns that it was going to be an aggressor. Economically, it's emerged as a crucial partner for every single country in the region. And Southeast Asia stands out from the other countries examined or the other regions examined here just due to geography and history. As John said, we talked about them being an oddity in the Middle East. They're far from that in Southeast Asia. China actually shares a border with Burma, Laos. It comes very close with Thailand, as well as Vietnam. It has deep historical ties. The ancient kingdoms of mainland Southeast Asia traded with China. Probably testament to it is that there are about 25 or 30 million ethnic Chinese who live in Southeast Asia. Now, these people are Southeast Asians first and foremost, but they are Chinese, of Chinese ethnicity, and they serve as a useful bridge between China and Southeast Asia. But 20th century was sort of a downtime for China-Southeast Asia relations, just like it was a downtime for China. China was weak at the end of the Qing Dynasty, went through the war, emerged in 1949 as the People's Republic of China. One of the principal foreign policy aims of the PRC was the support of communist movements around the world, and there was no exception in Southeast Asia, where it offered active and material support for communist insurgencies in every single country in the region, aside from Brunei and Singapore. Clearly, this didn't go over very well in capitals in Southeast Asia, and ties were either suspended or severed during this period. Things got better in the 1980s and 1990s, but Southeast Asia was again reminded that China might not be an entirely benign force. In 1995, in the Mischief Reef incident, in which it was It was discovered that China had been building facilities on Mischief Reef and the Spratly Islands in the South China Sea, which is variously claimed by Vietnam, Malaysia, the Philippines, Brunei, and also Taiwan. And this turned out to be a major turning point for China in its approach to Southeast Asia. It decided that, ASEAN did an incredibly good job of coming together as a group and confronting China, and China saw the possibility of an anti-China bloc, perhaps with U.S. support, emerging. And it decided to just completely change its tune, basically, and begin its charm offensive, so-called charm offensive in Southeast Asia. Now, why does China think that Southeast Asia is important to it? Why did it need a charm offensive? For the sake of a 10-minute presentation, I'd just like to divide up Southeast Asia into two distinct areas. One's mainland Southeast Asia and one maritime. In mainland Southeast Asia, you have Burma, Thailand, Laos, Vietnam, and Cambodia. China is very interested in having good relations with these countries. First of all, because it shares a border, and China has a policy that it wants stable and prosperous border countries, which makes sense. Secondly, the Chinese province that borders these countries is Yunnan. Yunnan is a landlocked, very poor province in China. China's very concerned about income inequality within China for reasons of social stability. And so it wants to link up Yunnan to the rest of the world. And the way to do that is through Burma, Thailand, Laos, and Cambodia. They've done this by, really, they've transformed the region by constructing major infrastructure projects. I mean, if there's any place in the world where Chinese influence is tangible, it's in northern Burma, Laos, and to some extent Thailand. And a corollary purpose for seeking these routes is that China is incredibly concerned about the security of the Strait of Malacca and being able to run supply routes down through Burma, Laos, Cambodia to get to the supply lines through Burma to get to the Bay of Bengal by avoiding the Strait of Malacca is certainly a concern. Chinese interest in maritime Southeast Asia, where some of the larger economies are, has much more to do with markets, natural resource extraction, because that's where the natural resources are for the most part, and freedom of navigation of sea lanes. Now, how has China done this, this so-called charm offensive? They've been very successful diplomatically. They speak the language of Southeast Asia, speak the language of ASEAN, really appealing to multilateral sensibilities in the region and also stressing sovereignty. They won, for rightly or wrongly, they won a lot of credit for their response to the 1997 financial crisis. Certainly, they were acting in their own interest by not devaluing their currency in 1997, but what's remembered is that China helped them, the United States didn't. They've also moved forward on assuaging concerns on the South China Sea, formalizing the 2002 Declaration of Conduct in the South China Sea. They've used bold policy initiatives. They announced the intention to craft a free trade agreement with Southeast Asia, with ASEAN in 2000, which is coming online right now. They were the first country to sign ASEAN's Treaty of Amity and Cooperation, a symbolic document that now about 15 other countries have signed, most recently North Korea, but we haven't done it. It's a priority location for diplomats. They send their best there, and they learn the languages, and by all accounts, they do an excellent job. It's also backed up by a seemingly endless supply of high-level officials to send to even the most minor of meetings in Southeast Asia. This all plays very well in Southeast Asia. But the big story has been economic, particularly on the trade front. Emerging from about zero in 1990 in terms of China-Southeast Asia trade, it's on target, or at least until the financial crisis, had been on target to reach its target of $200 billion annually. The United States and Japan are still incredibly important, but at least until recently, China was expected to overtake them. Investment has been pretty minimal to this point, but everyone, until this crisis, was expecting it to increase rapidly. Most of the investment that there is in oil and LNG out in maritime Southeast Asia. However, while being a small investor in Burma, Cambodia, and Laos, all the other countries are even smaller investors. So their small amount of investment has brought them a lot of clout. China's also been active on exchange programs, the Confucius Institute, 17 in Southeast Asia, 13 of which were in Thailand, actually, at last count. Very interesting program bringing Chinese language teachers into Southeast Asian high schools, actually, particularly in Thailand, Cambodia, and Laos. At last check, there were 800 of them teaching in Thai high schools. Found that to be interesting. So what has China achieved? For the sake of a 10-minute presentation, I'd say that China has become the most important outside power for Laos, Cambodia, and Burma. It has arguably become the most important outside power for Thailand and Vietnam, but these countries are certainly not dependent on China. As you move farther away from China, you get to Indonesia, Malaysia, Singapore, Philippines. These are stronger states with more leverage, more skepticism. They also have less, at least in the case of Indonesia, they have a tougher time because the ethnic Chinese population isn't as well integrated as in places like Thailand, and you sort of have a division in society and resentment towards Chinese Indonesians and to some extent Chinese Malaysians, and that sort of colors relations actually between those countries. While China's made a lot of progress, there are a few flashpoints that are worth mentioning. I think we were all reminded last weekend that the South China Sea issue, while certainly dormant, is certainly not settled. Another thing to watch is environmental degradation on the Mekong River that runs from the Tibetan Plateau down through Burma, Laos, Thailand, Cambodia, before reaching the Mekong Delta in Vietnam. China's built a number of dams in their own territory on this. They've also encouraged a lot of dredging of the river and destroying shoals and reefs and rapids to increase navigability of it, again, to link so that you could use the Mekong to deliver goods from Yunnan southward. In any case, real degradation is starting to really show its face, particularly in Cambodia and Vietnam. Flood patterns, the annual flood patterns of the in the Delta have been disrupted, sort of disrupting rice production in Vietnam. The Tonle Sap, the major lake in Cambodia, has been unpredictable, and fish production is reportedly way down. All in all, I'd say that China's emergence is really returning things to a normal state of affairs. It's natural that China should be an incredibly important player in Southeast Asia. But it's not that these countries are in love with China or their political system or anything. These are very poor, small countries that seek stability and they want to develop their economies. And they sense a buyer's market. If the United States or Japan, Korea, Australia, anybody else would come to them offering something, they're going to think about it very seriously. And China's just been doing a lot of offering recently. And it's certainly not zero sum. There's plenty of room for the United States and China. We want the same things. We want stability and growth. We want secure sea lanes. And I'll just close by saying that perhaps the greatest strength for the U.S. position in Southeast Asia is the fact that it's not just the United States and China in Southeast Asia. It's also Japan, South Korea, Australia, India, allies, and close partners of the United States. So it's not just Japan and the United States and China. It's the United States, a bunch of its allies, and China.
That's right. We're going to open it up in a minute, but if I could ask the first question. Looking at the financial crisis and the meltdown, essentially, of the twin engines of global growth, the United States and China, how will China's significant economic downturn projected for the next few years impact its investment in your regions and, therefore, its benefits of its soft power, which seem to be largely economic and pragmatic?
You know, first of all, I think it's important to recognize the scale of these countries' relationships with China vis-a-vis their important relationships around the world. China isn't their most important trading partner. China is the place where they might see the most upside growth, but it's simply not the major market for their goods, the major source of their goods. So I think in some ways China is neither a key part of the problem nor a key part of the solution. Overall in the Middle East, I think the more profound problems from the economic downturn are going to come from the labor exporting countries rather than the oil exporting countries. If people are really interested, A, you're in the wrong meeting because you should be in one of my meetings. But I think it will be the oil exporters who are able to rely on their cushions, and those are principally the countries with which China has the most important relationships, because China's interests in the Middle East are driven by their energy needs. How does any of this affect Iran? I think it, you know, which is the other sort of country. I didn't talk very much about Iran, but Iran is interested geopolitically for the Chinese, and the Chinese role is, I think, important as we think about geopolitical response to Iran. But there are so many other factors that are affecting both Chinese-Iranian relations and Iran's relationship with the rest of the world that I think the economic downturn principally affects Iran, in that the country has much less oil earnings, and therefore its diplomatic position is weakened, rather than somehow this strengthens China, weakens China, changes China's position. I think it's really it's Iran's relationship with the outside world in general, not China's narrow relationship with Iran, that is the game changer.
With respect to Latin America, China has, over the past number of years, pursued partnerships with and investments with respect to commodities, copper in particular, and also energy, oil. The drop in commodity prices certainly may slow demand and cause contraction of those sectors. But on the other hand, there's been a significant increase or effort to distribute manufactured goods in the region as well. That's caused tensions in parts of Mexico and Central America, where there's perceived competition for the influx of manufactured goods from China. However, lower prices on some of those goods may be more appealing to populations that have less purchasing power.
Yeah, I guess in Africa, I mean, a number of countries, it'll impact significantly. I mean, particularly as mineral demand goes down and so forth. I mean, I'm thinking of Zambia, DRC, which doesn't have much of an economy otherwise. And I think actually that will be where the soft power aspects hit a big challenge. And I think our soft power strategy is going to hit a big challenge too, as we face a fiscal deficit here and you know, possibly diminishing assistance flows to Africa. I think how China weathers that and how it responds to what will almost certainly be increasing hardship and food insecurity in a lot of those countries is going to be a big test. I don't want to play it out too far, because I think the impacts overall are unknown at this point. I mean, the African countries are getting hit from a variety of angles. China will be an important one, but others as well. But that may actually become a greater focus at the upcoming FOCAC than was originally planned.
China is an incredibly important trading partner for countries in Southeast Asia as part of their overall portfolio. So certainly, and a lot of the clout that China has carried in the past few years is not based on what China is right now; it's expectations of what China might be 10 or 20 years from now. And things that they have done so far have mostly been symbolic, but they've been really good at the symbolism. I think some countries were expecting them to really back it up in the coming decade or two, and it just remains to be seen whether they'll be able to do that.
Thanks. If we could take a few questions first for John Alterman, because I think he has to leave a little early. Yes? So if raise your hand if you have a John Alterman Middle East question. We're going to start down here. And then we'll bundle three. So if we could do here, and then these two gentlemen in the back.
Thank you. I'm Jim Buses from the American Jewish Committee. At the first part of this session before you came on, they said that part of the soft power is a reflection of how people view how China manages its own internal affairs. And so with that in mind, I wonder, to what extent do Arabs and Muslims know that there are a significant number of Muslims within China? And to the extent that they do know, to what extent are they happy or unhappy with the way those Muslims are treated in China?
Ahmed Mir, I just wanted to mention that you didn't say anything about Pakistan and the Chinese relationship. It's a good model because of the tremendous collaboration they have, and India also. No, it wasn't covered. Thank you.
Lee Bo-Lee again with the Voice of America. Question for Mr. Ottoman. How far can China go in the Middle East with the soft power, considering religion is of paramount importance in the region, while China is not particularly considered as being very kind to religion? Thank you.
Islam in China is really interesting. One of the most interesting conversations I had in Beijing was going to the Islamic Center and talking to some people around there. I think Islam in China is changing. There are many different... there are people who really know this stuff, so I can send you books if you're really interested. Islam in China is really a fascinating subject, and there's a lot of diversity in Islam in China. There are communities which have different origins, different practices, different patterns of veiling, dressing, behavior. It's an absolutely fascinating subject about which I only know a little bit. And a lot of that diversity seems to be diminishing. A lot, in many cases, Islam in China is both becoming more homogenized and more like Islam in other places. And Chinese Muslims see this as a sign of modernity, that they are uniform with Muslim practice around the world. And the number of Chinese who go on pilgrimage is increasing and things like that. This is of some concern to Chinese authorities who see things going on in global Islam that they're less comfortable with, not only the sort of Salafi jihadi stuff, but other aspects of Islam and Islamic belief and practice that they see as being sort of off message. I haven't gotten any sense that this particularly bothers folks in the Arab world, but I certainly could see ways in which it might in the future. And I think that the Chinese government hasn't quite figured out what it would do about Islam any more than it's figured out what it's doing with resurgent Buddhism and other kinds of things that are going on. One of the interesting things for me, as somebody who really is deeply ignorant about China, is seeing how many halal restaurants are in Beijing. I mean, there are a lot of them. A heck of a lot more halal restaurants in Beijing than there are kosher restaurants in New York. So just as an example, many more. So I think that this ultimately has not only to do with the Middle East, not only to do with religion, but has a lot to do with where China is evolving as a society and what's going to happen to religion in China as we think about what's going to happen to religion around the world. Let me also say that what I didn't talk about at all, but is very interesting, is the Chinese relationship with Israel. Israel has invested a tremendous amount reaching out to Middle East scholars in China. A number of Middle East experts I met with in China had spent maybe 2 or 3 months in one Arab country and Israel. The Israelis have done tremendous outreach, I think partly to try to create friendships, partly to try to use Chinese influence with Iran, with Syria, with other places to sort of have China as a constructive actor. There also, of course, have been military deals between Israel and China, which the United States has acted very, very vigorously to cut off. But this is an interesting role the Chinese have been able to play, whereby they're able to maintain strong and growing relationships with two utterly antagonistic parties. And I think the United States, our inclination is, which side are you on? And the Chinese diplomatic view is we don't have to choose sides. As far as Pakistan, I don't doubt that China-Pakistan is fascinating. One of the deals I have, all my turf battles, I get rid of turf. And I just refuse to look at anything east of the eastern border of Iran. On a matter of principle, I leave the Sudan and Mauritania to Jennifer. And I only go to Turkey because it's really wonderful, even though it's kind of part of Europe. But I just don't do Pakistan. That was about religion, and I think the religion question is much more, not so much about where China is, but where China is going and going to be. And, you know, Islam is dynamic as well, and I think what we're ultimately going to see is an interplay between the two rather than one establishing as a road, one creating itself as a roadblock to the other. I think we're going to see adaptation, creativity. You know, I think, you're in the wrong meeting if you want to hear me say this, but I think that one of the fascinating things about Islam is there's a crisis of authority in Islam, and that means that the opportunity for inputs to Islam in China, right, it's a much more dynamic space than it might have been 10, 15 years ago.
Thanks, John. I know you have to go, but thanks for being here.
Thank you.
We're going to open it up to questions for our other colleagues right here.
Thanks. J.R. Warner from the U.S.-China Commission. I noticed that you spoke about different Chinese companies causing problems for the Chinese image. You mentioned Zambia, Sudan, Peru, and I think Gabon. What effort has the Chinese government made to mitigate the negative effects that Chinese companies, which are increasingly acting as profit-driven ventures rather than just branches of the state, what are they doing to mitigate the negative effects on the Chinese image? Thanks.
Well, I mean, it is interesting because they're mostly state-owned entities that are causing a lot of the problems, but there is a divergence of interest when you start talking about soft power and global interest, and I think that was most starkly evident in Sudan, where, you know, the Chinese oil company is pursuing its bottom line agenda, but the Chinese government writ large had a much bigger, broader soft power problem at its hands, and so you had the one undermining the other. And in fact, I think diplomatically, there were efforts by China to mitigate that, and you know, not dramatic in Western terms in their language to the government in Khartoum, but pretty significant shift for China in calling attention to that we must work to resolve this crisis in Darfur. I mean, that was pretty significant at the time. And quiet encouragement to Bashir, not nearly what, you know, Western advocates would have liked to seen in trying to move towards a solution, supporting the Annan plan for the deployment of peacekeepers and the hybrid peacekeeping force. You know, all of that is to the positive. Again, it wasn't up to Western expectations on that, but a pretty significant shift internally. In Angola, I think, you know, for example, I think a lot of it is going to have to come through the governments themselves. I mean, China will go for a maximal approach, I think, each time, just as, you know, most countries would, until there's pushback on them to moderate. And Angola, the big question is the employment, you know, massive, I think someone before mentioned, massive rates of unemployment, and yet Angola, you know, Chinese workers are doing all of these, virtually all of the infrastructure projects in Angola. That's in some ways a choice of the Angolan government to meet the urgent need for reconstruction and get these things done quickly, cheaply, and efficiently in the short term. But I think as their... As that urgency subsides, they're going to be pushing back harder on China to abide by the quotas, or pushing back on themselves to abide by the quotas that they've set in place. Again, it's not. I don't think the Chinese government has really proactively tried to preempt any of these issues, except through some of its soft power. Except through some of its diplomatic rhetoric. But when pushed, it's shown itself to be quite flexible. And I think the South Africa is a case in point. South Africa ultimately didn't take full advantage of that voluntary quota, and so Bangladesh and Pakistan came in to kind of... And South Africa ultimately got no benefit from it, but that wasn't China's fault. That's South Africa's.
Just quickly, I had referred to some controversy in Peru with respect to mining activities. In the paper, I refer to a couple of different ones. One to which I refer is a government-owned company. The other, I'm not sure I know right now what the connection was, but it's in the paper.
It was written a while ago.
I know, that's true. I would say with respect to the mines, one of the disputes has to do with the moving of an entire community in order to undertake extractive activities. The other had to do with environmental degradation at the site of the mine. My understanding is that with respect to the move of the community, there has been an ongoing discussion over the compensation package, and you know, people are upset about having to move, from historic, from their longtime community. What I would say sort of more generally is that both Chinese business and government funding seems to be working towards sponsoring greater links between the business community at large in Latin America and Chinese business. And there have been a number of fora over the past number of years designed to bring business and government leaders together to talk about business practices. And so it may be that those offer opportunities for discussion about environmental concerns as well.
Hi, I'm Bo Kong from Johns Hopkins SAIS. First of all, congratulations to all you all on this major undertaking. And I have a couple questions in mind. One question relates to the question asked by the gentleman on the impact of Chinese companies' practices overseas and the collateral damage they pose, they pose for China's overall soft power. Obviously, so far, as the first panels indicated, the Chinese government doesn't have a coordinated, coherent, strategy to really project the country's soft power. In absence of that coherent and coordinating, strategy, when you have companies that Chinese state-owned companies that actively, expand overseas, not necessarily to promote the country's interest, but their own commercial interests. In light of the economic reforms which unleashed the commercial instinct of those entities, and not to mention that the small, as Jennifer, as you pointed out, there's this grassroots army in Africa, from China, composed primarily of Chinese private entrepreneurs, and the image of China's soft power in those hosting countries certainly is constructed based on people's perception of how those companies operate. So my question is this: in absence of a coordinated and coherent strategy, to what extent do you see China? To what extent can China actually effectively promote soft power? Number one, and number two, since this project covers different regions, I want to if you guys have looked into key variables that account for variation of, China's soft power in different regions. For example, in Southeast Asia and Africa, why, do you see differences in terms of how China's soft power, fares in the two different regions? If so, what accounts for the differences? And finally, I wonder, Jennifer and other people have commented on this ambitious effort of the Chinese government to build its own CNN. I wonder if you guys can comment on the constraints that confront the Chinese government to build the CNN, the expansion of $40 billion Chinese yuan to build to expand China's cultural enterprise overseas. I wanted to, wonder if you can comment on the constraints that the Chinese government will face to actually accomplish that objective. Thank you.
Sure. On the small businesses and the kind of reputational challenges of kind of small businesses, I think that's something that a lot of Chinese that we were talking to and some of the think tanks were particularly concerned about, because it's not something that that China can particularly control. And I don't know that there's a strategy for dealing with that, and whether there's petty corruption and so forth, which is sometimes the easiest way to get things done in some of the countries, how to put constraints on that. Let me go to the third question. Maybe on the cultural question. You know, there is, I failed to mention it, but there is a major expansion in Africa, too, of language training, of cultural institutes. Diplomatic presence is in some ways proportionately higher than that in the United States and these exchanges. When I was in Beijing at random, I ran into three African trade delegations, you know, while visiting the Forbidden City, who were there for 6 weeks at a time or 2 months at a time, and it was actually quite interesting. But I think there's still, that's going to be a big challenge, partly because of the language issue. I think still remains a major barrier. You are seeing more Africans drawn, I think, by the economic opportunities than by, necessarily kind of cultural affinity to learn Chinese. But it's still a very small, I think, small proportion. And the question of interaction with non-government entities, I think, is still awkward and maybe difficult for the Chinese government to do. I don't think it's got its arms around that entirely yet. And that goes to the point about religion, too. How do you factor that in kind of a non-political way? How do you engage with religious leaders and so forth? All of those, I think, remain big challenges. There are big cultural distinctions. And I think it goes both ways. As I said, in a lot of big African cities, there will be communities of Chinese living together. I think without a whole lot of kind of social interaction with the communities around them. I think that's normal and will maybe change over time. Same in China. There are large communities of Africans, and I'm not sure that would be very interesting for me to study on how they've integrated socially within Chinese large cities. On the cross-cutting issues, maybe I should leave one of my colleagues to answer that one.
Just with respect to the question, I think your question was, in the absence of a coherent strategy, how is China or how can it promote soft power in the different regions? Did I get that right? One thing that was interesting in the interviews that we conducted was that, you know, many people said, you know, historically, and I mean, this is looking, I guess, more at the diplomatic training, but they said historically there was a perception in Latin America that diplomats from China did not speak the language very well and, you know, did not have a deep immersion in Latin American culture, sort of generally. But they said that in recent years they feel that that has changed considerably, in part because of a strategic decision and you know, just in part because of the region of China's greater involvement in the region. And they said, you know, they're seeing young diplomats who speak Spanish or Portuguese very, very well, who, you know, are preparing, you know, not to just do one tour in the region, but to really kind of focus and become Latin America experts. And, you know, they feel that, you know, whether that's part of a grand strategy or, you know, something that has just happened because of greater interaction, that is something that is bound to increase the ties between the regions over time.
On the cross-cutting issue, I'm looking across regions. I think that the various papers sort of show that China takes a very pragmatic, tailored approach to each country and each region. And the key factors are obviously resources, geography, especially in the case of Southeast Asia, and Taiwan. I mean, that's a big factor, as Catherine talked about, in China's engagement in Latin America, and less so elsewhere. If you're a country that doesn't have any resources and recognizes the PRC and is on the other side of the world, you probably won't get much attention from China. So there are a number of different factors, but each country is looked at in a targeted way. So we've got time for a few more. Oh, go ahead.
Well, I think in Africa in particular, there's it's very easy to play against the differences and the mistakes that the West has made over time. I mean, that's why I think you get such an emphasis on the long history of engagement that has been based really on trade and exchange versus domination, colonization, structural adjustment, the Cold War. I mean, China really, in every conversation, really posits itself as different from that. And I'm not sure that I don't know the other regions as well, but I don't know that it can play on that.
It's more baggage.
More baggage in Asia than in Africa. I mean, it does have a very positive history to point to, and it can play against those differences and play itself as an alternative to West.
Hi, my name is Tani. I'm from the Thai Embassy.
I want to thank all the speakers for their wonderful presentations and for putting into proper context China's role in different regions. My question that I've been dying to ask in many conferences in Washington is that why is there so much interest or even suspicion of the rise of China in Washington? Southeast Asia is right next to China. That's my question number one. My question number two is that Southeast Asia is right next to China. There seems to me, at least, that they're not as alarmed of the growing role of China in the world. Why? Maybe I'm wrong. Has the Chinese charm offensive been that effective in the region?
Whether you agree with it or not, there is a lot of concern, as you note, about China's rise, and particularly in Washington. And that's because there's a general sense of strategic mistrust between the two countries. We have no idea what China's long-term intentions are. Very strong military, a lot of shared interests that might be competitive in terms of resources. And frankly, if you look at China's defense documents, the United States is listed as a potential competitor, adversary. And a lot of China's military development is focused on a potential conflict with the United States. Now, the United States does the same thing. But if you are looking at those who see China as a military threat, they might be hoping for the best but need to hedge for the worst. If you are looking at those who see China as an economic threat, then we're talking about lost jobs and things that really hit home to many American communities. Now, I personally don't take that perspective, but you have a Congress that is responsible to many constituents who don't have an opportunity to learn much about China, who might be hard hit in this financial crisis, but also in the past, and who hear stories on CNN and elsewhere about China taking away what Americans want and need. Now, the focus in our view in this project is that there's also some basic differences of Chinese and American values, and certainly one issue in Southeast Asia, as you raise, is the question of Burma and how we approach that issue, or Sudan, or elsewhere. But primarily, it's the military increases, budget increases, and the economic power. Go ahead, Jennifer.
I think that factor, in some ways, even though I'm not a China expert, that kind of fear of the massive growth and what does it mean and does it displace the United States as the world's economic power, kind of colors how people have viewed, for example, the China-Africa and relationship. And so there was a lot of hype and exaggeration in the fears around that. You know, China is gobbling up Africa's oil resources. Well, when you look at the facts, the U.S. imports 33% of Africa's oil. Europe imports 44%, and China imports 9%. And, China on a per capita basis consumes about 1/13 of what the United States does in terms of in oil. But that fear, I think, colored and infused a lot of the debates around it. I think that's calmed somewhat down now, and people are seeing the benefits of it as well. So there might be legitimate fears. I don't really know. But I think, particularly in terms of these regional relationships, you kind of have to look at the facts on the ground first, and I think some of that hysteria or the overblown hopes and the overblown fears, I think, are settling down to something more pragmatic now.
I'll just say I share your frustration, Tenny, this is the kind of thing, the China issue is just something, obviously, an irritant in U.S.-Thai relations where Thai is, and you wonder why all these Americans keep coming to Bangkok asking about China, and because it does, and all the Thais will say, well, China never comes here and talks about the United States, I agree with Jennifer and Carolyn.
Yeah, in Southeast Asia in particular, the United States is a Pacific power, and we have strategic interests in the region. So I think it's slightly different than, say, looking at China's role in Latin America, where it's just not a comparison in terms of neighborhood relationships. But it's primarily about Taiwan and sort of their strategic the place in sorry, I'm sorry. and also sea lanes of control, and really looking at who is going to control them in the future and making sure they're open to the United States, both in terms of our military and commercial and energy needs. So I expect that that will continue to be an issue.
Well, first of all, I've been intrigued by the difference between the Chinese and the U.S., Joseph Nye's view of soft power. And one of the terms that hasn't played into the discussion at all is the perception of coercion to policies from China and the U.S. U.S. does not necessarily consider some of its economic interests to be coercive in the way they shape soft power. The second piece that is interesting in the discourse so far is the diversity in which the U.S. approaches other nations in extending its soft power. So we have NGOs, we have businesses, we have government. China has a much more unilateral approach, and yet we don't consider it to be coherent. So I guess looking forward, if we look, for example, at what happened during the Olympics and the extent in which the Tibetan issue arose, that was an issue that had significant blowback on China. It was an issue that you can't control from a centralized way. So culture is essentially an infusion of ideas that isn't necessarily coherent entirely. It is something that comes from religion and other forces. China has been trying to control it, but it may not be something that actually serves them as much as it does the U.S. if the U.S. actually moves forward with non-coercive policies. Any comments on that? And I think this is especially true perhaps in Southeast Asia.
Well, in terms of coercion, coercing Southeast Asian nations, I don't think China's done a whole lot of that. I think it generally has been a benign power. I'd say the one major exception is on the Taiwan issue. And it has, you know, it wants to engage with all the countries in the region and will offer aid to significant aid around. But the one condition attached is that you will limit Taiwan's political room in the area. So on that issue, they have not compromised. But otherwise, I wouldn't say that China's been trying to be a coercive power whatsoever.
Is it extending itself through other than governmental forces, through religion or the freedom of other sectors, no NGO influences?
I don't think so at all. I think it's genuinely been a benign power to this point. I think it's there are plenty of their suspicions. The farther you get away from China, except for Vietnam, it certainly has their suspicions. But to this point, China has only, it actually has been win-win. There, aside from the Taiwan issue, China's presence has just been a positive force for good in Southeast Asia.
I think it gets to the point that Jennifer raised, which is the economic component of soft power really soft power? And there's a debate on it, and that's why some people are calling it sticky power. But if China, and it's the question that's come up in the United States about China's holding of our foreign exchange reserves. How much influence does that have over us, and how much influence does their economic might in these regions ultimately give China over the political decisions? And that we don't know, but so far, that's just a debate of whether it's hard or soft power. Some would say, I've had people say to me that China doesn't have any soft power. And it goes to this question.
On the networks within China, I think that's be something to watch over the next 10 years. But for example, an environmental movement within China, I think it's, or the health movement within China, I think it's being very domestically focused. And over time, whether that expands and kind of you start building multiple relationships versus the simply governmental and the small businessmen, which is becoming an increasing one, is the question. On the coercion side, there's certainly been no overt coercion. I mean, it has allied itself in certain instances with coercive regimes, but on the rhetoric side, it's kind of this assuaging the China threat perception. I think it's been very careful on that. And frankly, the U.S. has probably used more hard power in Africa in recent years and launching tomahawks into Somalia and on the sanctions on Sudan and so forth. And China posits itself as a much more passive, reactive actor that's going to follow the lead of Africans in a number of these instances where we want to push them. On the ICC ruling in Darfur, we're following the African Union lead on that, which is true. The African Union is calling us it. On Zimbabwe, well, if SADC wants to push Mugabe harder, we'll go along with that, but we're following the African lead on that. And so presumably if SADC or African Union becomes more galvanized on some of these issues, China won't want to be left behind, but it's not going to move out in front of them on some of those issues.
Hi, Julie Sheets with Brooks Bauer Asia. My question is about something you also didn't touch on, so I don't know if this is necessarily a Middle East question or this is an Africa question, but the question of Somalia. I know China recently sent a delegation of ships to protect its merchant interests there, and there was a lot of reaction in China, Japan, Southeast Asia about what this means for China's military projection abroad. And obviously you just said this is one of the key issues for our relationship with China as well. So I'm sort of wondering what the response is in the Middle East and Africa. If there is a response, is this seen as something big in a turnaround, or is this just a lot of other people projecting their own fears on the issue?
On the Somalia deployment, I mean, first of all, they have hard interests at play. So it's not, I don't think it's necessarily a soft power projection. Although, as John said, you know, there is a tendency to say, okay, you guys do the security stuff, and then we'll go in and make the deals a little bit. And that's been true on peacekeeping and issues like that, although China now has bolstered that peacekeeping forces within Africa. And I think that plays perhaps not to African targets for soft power, but to the international targets of soft power, saying, look, we are partners on the global stage, and we'll shoulder our burden in that respect. I don't think there's been a lot of reaction in Africa to that, but I don't think that was directed at an African audience necessarily, but more to an international community writ large.
We are out of time, so I want to thank you very much for joining us. I hope you get a copy of the report and also look up the other one online, and please join me in thanking my colleagues for their presentations.